We are diving deep today into one of the really crucial documents that came out of the nuclear industry after Fukushima.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's basically the blueprint for how a major facility handles a disaster that's, well, literally beyond what it was originally designed for. We're talking about beyond design basis external events, or BDBEs. After the 2011 accident, you know, the NRC issued this order, EA-12049.
Right.
It basically forced every U.S. nuclear plant to figure out strategies for dealing with losing all AC power and their main cooling water source at the same time.
Exactly. And what we're focusing on is the Tennessee Valley Authority's plan for the Browns Ferry Nuclear Plant, BFNP. It's their Diverse and Flexible Coping Strategies Plan. Most people just call it FLEX.
FLEX.
And it's way more than just tweaking procedures. It's like a whole new layer of backup system.
A new safety net.
Pretty much. The FLEX plan adds these critical layers of defense in depth. They're specifically designed to kick in when all the normal sort of seismically qualified systems have failed. And it's laser focused on three things: keeping the reactor core cool, making sure the containment building stays intact, and keeping that spent fuel pool water level up. Non-negotiables.
So our mission today is really to unpack this, to get inside this complex engineering and logistics plan and see exactly how Browns Ferry intends to cope if the absolute worst happens. Okay, let's start with the threats themselves. I mean, the whole plan depends on knowing what you're up against locally.
Definitely.
What specific BDBE hazards did Browns Ferry say, okay, these are the things our FLEX gear has to survive and respond to?
All right, so based on the industry guidance, NEI 1206, BFNP pinpointed five main credible threats for their site.
Five.
Earthquakes, seismic events, external flooding, severe high winds, including tornadoes, then extreme cold, ice, snow, and finally extreme heat. The plan has to work against any one of those.
And when you dig into their hazard analysis, some of the numbers are, well, they jump out at you, like for earthquakes.
Yeah, the FLEX equipment itself, the generators, the pumps, has to be okay, like functionally okay, even after a quake causing 0.2G horizontal acceleration at the rock level.
0.2G, that's shaking equal to, what, 20% of gravity?
Yeah.
That's pretty intense.
It is. It's a significant design requirement for boardable gear. And importantly, the documents also show where they knew they needed more info. They flagged what they called an open item, specifically to check the liquefaction risk for the main haul routes.
Liquefaction.
Right.
Where the ground basically turns to soup during a quake.
Exactly. Because you could have the toughest generator in the world perfectly safe in its bunker.
But if the road to where you need it becomes quicksand,
you're stuck. You can't deploy it. So that logistical weak point had to be looked at very closely.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
Okay. What about flooding?
Two main risks there: heavy local rain and the Tennessee River flooding. Their analysis showed the probable maximum flood, like the absolute worst case theoretical flood, would reach a still water level of 572.5 feet. But operationally, they have a big timing advantage built in.
How so?
Well, the plant itself, the important buildings, sit at 565 feet elevation.
Okay.
But their procedure says they start shutting down the plant way earlier when the river hits 558 feet.
Ah, so that gives them a buffer. How much time does that actually buy them?
The plan estimates over 4 days, T-minus 190 hours specifically, before water would even reach that 565-foot plant-grade level.
4 days, that sounds like a lot, but I guess if you're trying to move and secure massive generators and pumps, maybe with high winds starting to pick up too, it's 4 days really comfortable.
Well, it forces a very intense period of activity. They have to get all that phase two equipment moved from storage to the designated spots, hook everything up.
Like a race against the clock.
Absolutely. It's basically a high-stress construction project happening under emergency conditions within that four-day window. Not a lot of downtime.
And quickly on the weather, extreme snow and cold in Alabama.
Yeah, sounds odd, but the historical data they used showed snowfalls up to like 17 inches.
Wow.
And a record low of minus 12 Fahrenheit. So yeah, the procedures have to account for crews potentially needing to deploy this stuff in icy, snowy conditions. Just connecting hoses could be a major challenge. Okay, so to handle all these potential simultaneous problems, the whole FLEX strategy breaks down into three phases. Time-based phases.
Phase one, two, and three.
Exactly. Phase one is the immediate reaction, like the first few hours, using only the installed equipment stuff already there, like batteries, steam-driven pumps, usually up to about 8 hours.
Okay.
Phase two is the transition. That's when they bring out the heavy-duty portable equipment stored on-site in those protected buildings to stabilize things.
And phase three.
That's the long haul, bringing in resources from off-site, usually from regional response centers, for sustained cooling and power.
Got it. Let's focus on phase one first. That initial window, TO due to, say, D plus 8 hours, a station blackout hits, all AC power gone. What happens right away? What are the absolute critical first steps using only that installed gear?
Okay, so it mirrors a standard station blackout response initially. Within about 30 seconds, automatically, two key high-pressure systems start up.
Which ones?
High-pressure coolant injection, HPCI, and the reactor core isolation cooling system, RCIC.
RCIC.
RCIC, right. Okay. And RCIC becomes the go-to system. It's basically a small turbine driven by the reactor's own steam and decay heat, powering a pump to keep water levels steady in the reactor vessel. Doesn't need outside electricity.
So that's the immediate lifesaver, keeping water over the fuel when the lights are out.
Precisely. But these systems aren't meant for the super long term by themselves. So by T plus 30 minutes, a really crucial step starts.
Which is?
Operators have to begin a controlled depressurization of the reactor vessel. They bring the pressure down slowly, about 100 degrees Fahrenheit per hour, aiming for a target pressure of 150 psig.
Okay, why 150 psi? What's magic about that number?
It's about enabling the next phase. Those high-pressure systems, RCIC and HPCI, are great initially, but the big phase two pumps, the ones drawing huge amounts of water from the river, are lower-pressure systems.
Ah, I see.
So you have to get the reactor pressure down low enough for those big external pumps to actually be able to push water into the vessel effectively later on.
So you use the high-pressure stuff to survive early, then drop pressure to allow the high-volume stuff to take over.
You got it. It's a planned transition.
And the clock is ticking on battery power this whole time, right? That's a huge constraint.
Absolutely critical. The DC batteries, powering instruments, and controls are tough, seismically qualified, but they don't last forever.
So what do they do?
There's a key manual action operators have to take within the first hour. Switch the suction for the HPCI pump. Instead of drawing from the main water storage tanks, they switch it to pull water from the suppression pool inside containment.
Why does that help?
It conserves that limited tank water and, more importantly, extends the battery life needed to control the system. And then there's load shedding.
Turning off non-essential stuff to save power.
Exactly. There's a strict deadline, T plus 4 hours. By that point, enough non-critical DC loads must be turned off to guarantee those batteries will last a full 12 hours.
12 hours. That gets them well past the T plus 8 hour target for phase two stability.
That's the goal. To ensure there's enough time for the phase two power systems to come online before the batteries run out.
And just to be clear, even though phase one relies on installed gear until T plus 8, the deployment of the phase two portable stuff starts way earlier.
Oh yeah, immediately. At T plus 0, the moment the event starts, crews are heading out to start moving those big pumps and generators. They're racing against that T plus 8 hour clock from the very beginning.
Okay, phase two. This is where FLEX gets really tangible, right? The on-site portable equipment, overcoming total loss of power and cooling by essentially bringing in a pre-staged mobile power plant and pumping station.
That's a good way to put it.
What exactly is in that flexible equipment storage building, the FESB? What's the core toolkit?
So the FESB itself is key. It's built tough, hardened, above the maximum predicted flood level, protected from wind, seismic events, all that.
Right.
Inside, the core principle is N plus one redundancy, meaning they have what they need, plus at least one spare for the critical stuff.
Makes sense. So power.
For primary power, they've got three big 4 kilovolt FLEX diesel generators. FMDGs, they call them. 3 megawatts each. These are the heavy lifters.
3 megawatts each. Wow.
Yeah. They're set up to connect to and re-energize the 4 kV shutdown boards. That gives them the juice to run major installed systems again, like their residual heat removal pumps, RHR, and the core spray system, CS.
Okay, so bringing the big plant systems back online with portable generator.
Exactly. And then they also have three smaller 480-volt FLEX DGs, FLDGs. These are mainly dedicated to keeping the essential battery chargers powered up, making sure those DC systems stay healthy long term.
Got it. And for water, how do they guarantee they can get water from the river, the ultimate heat sink?
That's the job of the FLEX pumping systems, or FPS. They have four big diesel-driven pumps. Three are needed, plus one spare, that N plus one again.
How much water can they move?
Each one is rated for 5,000 gallons per minute at 150 PSI. Huge capacity.
5,000 GPM each.
They deploy these right down near the river intake structure, and the system includes special floating booster pumps, too.
Why floating pumps?
That's to make sure they can still get good suction, even if the river level is unusually low, like during a drought that might happen at the same time as another event. covers that possibility.
Okay, so by T plus 8 hours, phase two is kicking in. The 4 kilo-V generators are running. The pumps are ready. How does core cooling change?
So with that 4 kilo-V power available, the core spray system gets energized. CS takes over the job of maintaining the water level in the reactor vessel, replacing the steam-driven RCIC, which did the job in phase one.
So CS becomes the primary injection source. What about keeping the containment building itself cool?
Once the 4 kV power is back, the big RHR pumps can be started in their containment cooling modes. That's the preferred way.
But what if something goes wrong? What if those 4 kV generators fail later or RHR has issues? There's a backup for containment cooling, too. It's the hardened containment vent system, or HCVS.
Right. It allows them to safely and controllably vent steam from the containment building to manage pressure and temperature if the RHR cooling isn't available. It's a crucial fallback.
Okay, one more critical area.
Yeah.
The spent fuel pool. Still a lot of heat there, even if the reactor is shut down.
Yeah.
What's the plan and timing for that?
Yeah, you can't forget the SFP. They calculated that under blackout conditions, it would take about 49.3 hours for the pool water to boil away enough to potentially uncover the fuel.
Okay, nearly 2 days. That seems like a decent amount of time.
It is, but they don't wait. The procedures require manual actions to prepare for SFP makeup water much earlier. Hoses need to be run and secured up on the refuel floor near the pool by T plus 3 hours.
3 hours, way before phase two is fully up.
Exactly. That's assuming a high heat load scenario in the pool. Getting the hoses ready early ensures that once the FLEX pumps, FPS1 specifically, are running later in phase two, they can immediately start adding river water to the pool, long before that 49-hour boil-off time becomes a concern. Lots of margin.
Okay, phase three. This is about keeping things stable indefinitely, right? And bringing in the cavalry from off-site.
That's the gist of it. Phase 3 relies heavily on the national infrastructure setup after Fukushima specifically, the Regional Response Centers, or RRCs.
RRCs. Tell me about those.
The industry created this group called Safer the Strategic Alliance for FLX Emergency Response. They manage two huge warehouses packed with emergency gear.
Two of them nationally?
Yep, holding 5 full sets of standardized FLX equipment each. Generators, massive pumps, hoses, electrical gear, everything. And crucially for Browns Ferry, one of these ROCs is in Memphis, Tennessee.
Memphis, so relatively close.
Exactly. Makes mobilization faster. When phase three is triggered, the Safer team starts moving that equipment. They set up a local staging area near the plant.
An assembly area.
Right. And the commitment is that the first wave of that RRC equipment will arrive on site within 24 hours of Browns Ferry making the request.
24 hours for major hardware reinforcement.
Yeah. And phase three is focused on providing things like more fuel for all the diesel engines, spare parts, replacement pumps or generators if the on-site ones fail, and also options like bringing in trucks of clean demineralized water if using river water long-term becomes an issue. Basically, sustainability and more redundancy.
Beyond the big machines, though, what about the people, the operators in the control room? It must get incredibly hot in there without normal AC during a blackout.
Oh, absolutely. That's a major human factors concern. They calculated that without any cooling, the main control room temperature would exceed 110 degrees Fahrenheit, somewhere between 19 and 24 hours into the event.
110F. That's generally considered the limit for people to work effectively, especially under stress.
Correct. It becomes a critical point where human performance could degrade significantly.
So what's the plan? What's the FLEX strategy for MCR habitability?
Well, the phase two plan involves deploying portable fans and potentially temporary cooling units once power is available. But there's an even earlier, simpler action. Back in phase one, if the temperature starts climbing, a key action is simply blocking open certain doors in the control room complex once the ambient temp hits around 93 or 94 degrees.
Just propping doors open.
Sounds basic, right? But the analysis showed that establishing that passive airflow path early on should be enough to keep the temperature below about 101 degrees Fahrenheit.
Buys them time.
Exactly. It buys time until the more robust phase two cooling solutions can be put in place. It's a low-tech backup focused on airflow.
Smart. Any other critical support functions like that?
One big one is hydrogen control in the battery rooms.
Ah, right. Charging batteries releases hydrogen.
Yep. And if it builds up, it can become explosive. Normally, ventilation systems handle this, but in a blackout.
Those might not be running initially?
Right. So if the normal ventilation can't be restored relatively quickly using the phase two generators, there are specific manual actions required by T plus 24 hours to monitor and manage hydrogen levels, likely involving portable fans or other measures to keep concentrations well below that 2% flammability limit. It shows how the timeline considers not just heat removal, but chemistry too. #tag outro.
Wow. So looking at the whole picture, the Browns Ferry FLEX plan is just this incredibly detailed, phased strategy for surviving a true nightmare scenario.
It really is.
The timing is so precise. T plus 30 minutes for depressurization, T plus 4 hours for load shedding, getting those huge 5,000 gallon per minute pumps and 3 megawatt generators lined up and running by T plus 8 hours. It's an immense logistical challenge.
The core ideas are that meticulous timing and layers of redundancy. N plus one spares, backup cooling methods like the HCVS, backup power for the battery chargers. It's all designed so that even if one thing fails, whether it's due to the initial event or a later problem, there's another layer ready to go.
It really elevates contingency planning.
It does, but here's maybe the final thought, something that really stands out when you read through the plan itself, even with all its detail.
Okay.
The document, all 100 plus pages, is still full of what they call open items at the time it was submitted. Things like needing final validation for certain calculations, needing more detailed staffing studies, fully analyzing those haul routes for liquefaction like we talked about.
So the plan was still evolving even as it was being finalized.
Exactly. And that kind of points to the ultimate challenge, doesn't it? The engineering design is incredibly complex and thorough, but the real hurdle, the thing that keeps safety experts focused, isn't just designing the hardware and procedures,
It's the
it's
execution.
ensuring the human element, the operators working under unbelievable stress, maybe in extreme heat or cold, the safer teams delivering equipment, the maintenance crews fixing things, ensuring that entire human system can execute this incredibly complex, precisely timed plan perfectly when everything has gone wrong.
That gap between the blueprint and flawless human performance under duress.
That's the piece you always have to keep considering. Can the people make the plan work when it truly matters most? That's the enduring question.